Hey, it's Ryan, co-host of The Journal. Our daily show will be back on Monday, but today we're going back into Second Life with the next episode in our series, How to Build a Metaverse. If you missed episode one, you'll definitely want to go check that out first. It's in our feed. It came out last Friday. Last week, founder Philip Rosedale and his company Linden Lab created Second Life, a metaverse where users could do and be whatever they wanted.
It isn't really about what the system's capabilities are, but instead, like, what it can do for you, you know, what it is for you. It is a second life that you get to live.
This week, Second Life experiences some growing pains. Here's producer Annie Minoff.
When Second Life officially launched in 2003, the people who showed up discovered a world where they could be anyone they wanted. And many of those early users began reinventing themselves, like Nancy Schenkein. Nancy, the former events planner who we met in episode one, came to Second Life after getting diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Life in the physical world was getting harder. But in Second Life, Nancy could be someone new. And it wasn't long before she settled on a name for this new someone. Bakara Rhodes. And Bakara, she had a look.
She had long hair, long, like, burgundy color hair. She's very classy, very classic. Watches her language and doesn't want language spoken around her. Very formal. A very formal type character.
Bakara wore ball gowns and fancy necklaces. She was a budding socialite whose idea of fun was hosting champagne cocktail parties for other avatars. But to host, she needed a house. One day, as Bakara was flying around Second Life, she noticed a lovely spot right by the water. And some of her new neighbors helped her build a little cottage there.
It had mostly basically a living room. It may have had a dining room thing. I don't think there was a bedroom. There was this big living room with a grand piano. How that got there, I don't even remember.
What were you doing at home? Were you, like, entertaining?
Sure. I would have guests over, you know, like a salon, you know.
And then one evening, as she was hosting a party, Bakara heard something coming from outside.
The shooting started, like crazy.
Other Second Life users were attacking her cottage. What, are you hearing it? Are you seeing it?
Oh, sure, you can hear it. And what they're doing is shooting at your house, and like clouds of smoke are coming up, and like my house was over some water. They were putting like bombs under there and then setting them off. It was a war zone, and I just didn't know.
Second Life was changing. As the platform left beta testing and threw open its doors to the entire internet, new users were coming in. And those new users brought their own, sometimes contradictory ideas about what a metaverse was for. For some, Second Life was a sandbox for building in. For others, it was a place to socialize or find love. And then there were those who saw Second Life as a war game, a place to battle and take pot shots at other users, users like Bakara. Second Life was entering its Wild West phase. Sex, violence, harassment, they were all infiltrating this new world and forcing Linden Lab to confront a kind of novel question. How exactly do you moderate a metaverse? From The Journal, this is How to Build a Metaverse. I'm Annie Minoff. This is part two, Avatars Behaving Badly.
This episode is brought to you by Workday. Get the whole band together with Workday and pair finance and HR on one platform for an epic performance. With Workday AI at the core, you'll make confident decisions faster than ever, and you'll drive flawless business and finance operations with an agile platform that constantly evolves to future-proof your organization. Be a finance and HR rockstar with Workday. Visit workday.com to learn more.
Peter Allow joined Linden Lab in 2002. This was back in the really early days. Second Life's official launch was still a year off, and Linden Lab consisted of about 10 people.
I think I was the first non-programmer that was hired there, not counting the person who ran the books and dealt with the paperwork.
Peter became Linden Lab's first community manager, a job that would become one of the most important at the company. Because it was Peter's job to figure out the rules governing this new world. But he wasn't entirely clear how to go about it. So he started looking around for inspiration.
I cribbed from maybe 6 different versions of terms of services for online worlds. I found the most common threads, I glued them together, and I wrote something like a nice 20-paragraph terms of service that sounded relatively legal but easy to read.
Peter felt pretty good about it, so he brought those 20 paragraphs to his boss, Linden Lab CEO Philip Rosedale.
And Philip said, okay, it's a good experiment. I'm glad we have all of this out here, but this is the terms of service, and it was be nice.
When he's like, be nice, okay.
I think I reacted the exact same way I reacted right now. I kind of laughed and like, okay, this is where we're going. All right, I'm sure there's going to be problems, but let's do this. Here we are.
It's worth remembering that this was early. There weren't exactly a lot of people in Second Life, and consequently, not a lot of behavior to moderate. It felt like they could afford to experiment.
Since we were jumping feet first into a space that nobody else had touched yet, he was willing to give it a shot of freedoms for everything and then work backwards.
Total freedom, see what happens, and then restrict.
Add limitations as required.
Peter's pages of rules, they were out. Instead, Linden Lab would wait to see what problems came up and deal with them from there. And problems did come up, like as soon as users hit the welcome area. This was 2003, right around the time of Second Life's official launch. Back then, the world of Second Life looked like Pangaea, one big continent with a handful of outlying islands. Within that continent, land was divided into square regions, and each region had its own name, like Hawthorne, Shipley, Tabor. To help them get their bearings, new Second Life users spawned into a designated welcome zone, a place with maps and navigation tips. And very quickly, the welcome area became a magnet for users looking to mess with others. Here's Daniel Huebner, who joined Linden Lab about a year after Peter, to work with him on governance issues.
In our late beta, just before we went commercially live in June of 2003, an avatar flew over the welcome area in a spaceship, had a pod door that opened, he tractor beamed other avatars up into his ship, and then flew away with them. And not only was this enormously funny, but none of the engineers in the company knew how to build that.
Wow.
This avatar had created something we didn't know how to make with the tools that we had provided and had exhibited a behavior that we had never anticipated. And it was just a moment of absolute awe. And certainly, there were abuse reports about it. Some of the people being tractor-beamed and abducted by aliens did not like that.
Right.
But at the same time, it's exactly what Second Life was made to do.
Linden Lab wasn't sure if it was okay or not to tractor-beam another Second Life user. But other forms of harassment that the company saw seemed a lot more clear-cut. What were the kind of more mundane, like, everyday things you would see?
Pushing.
Really?
Swearing.
Mm-hmm.
People saying offensive things, a lot of the things you'd see on the internet to this day, but with the added benefit of having physics.
Physics, it was becoming clear, made a difference in the metaverse. If someone disagreed with you in Second Life, sure, they could attack you over text chat, but they could also assault your avatar. And as this new world expanded and more people joined, more and more of these kinds of conflicts were breaking out. When Second Life officially launched, the internet was largely dominated by niche communities. There were online spaces for people into first-person shooter games and war simulators. There were communities built solely around virtual sex and romance. There were entire chat rooms just for fans of Justin Timberlake or Matchbox 20. And as those communities discovered and migrated into Second Life, they brought their own ideas of fun and appropriate behavior with them. That created tension and trouble for Linden Lab. Take, for example, a user named Stroker Serpentine, who migrated to Second Life in 2003 with very clear ideas about what this new world was for.
So if I were to enter Second Life and ask someone in the know, who is Stroker Serpentine, like, what would they tell me? What's your kind of reputation on the platform?
I am the grandfather of virtual sex.
You wear the title proudly, I think.
I do. I do, very much so.
In real life, Stroker is Kevin Alderman, an ex-plumber living in a 200-acre nudist community outside of Tampa. Kevin's married with grown kids, and he's been retired for about a decade. But he tells me he still works part-time as a security guard at the nudist resort. He calls it his Forrest Gump job, something to keep him busy.
One of the rules is you have to be nude to get into the swimming pool or the spa. And so I get several calls where people are unaware of the rules, and I have to tell them to get naked.
Kevin, I learn, is startlingly nonchalant about sex, which makes sense. When he arrived in Second Life almost 20 years ago now, he was already an online sex veteran. In the late 90s, he'd discovered a social networking site called Seducity. On Seducity, users could have sex as 2D avatars by typing out commands and triggering a spherical object called a pose ball.
They had a variety of these pose balls that would, once sat upon by your avatar, animate you in sexual positions. And they only had three.
Okay, only three positions.
They only had three, that was it.
Okay.
But it was quite titillating.
But not quite titillating enough. And that's where Second Life came in. When Seducity's users learned about a new virtual world where people could be anyone and do anything, they were intrigued. This seemed like a place where their fantasies could have freer rein. And so some of the citizens of Seducity migrated over into Second Life, only to find that this new metaverse was a bit lacking in the sex department.
There were a lot of images. There was a lot of pornography. You could go to meeting spots where they would have the walls covered in pornographic images, but there really wasn't any type of interaction available.
Available yet. Because Kevin was about to have a breakthrough. A breakthrough that would make Second Life a much sexier place and push Linden Lab's laissez-faire approach to its limits. Kevin figured that it might be possible to hack Second Life's native avatar animations to bring sex into Second Life.
I would take, like, the motorcycle animation, which was your arms are up, like holding a handlebar, and you're basically seated on a seat. And I would take that animation, and it would loop. It would stay on a loop, and I would cut that loop and then merge it with a standing animation. So that it would go from standing to that crouching position. And it simulated a doggy sex position. And that was my first. It was hacked from Motorcycle Sid.
So let's just take, for example, the Motorcycle Sid animation. This was an animation that, like, Linden Lab had put out there.
Correct.
And you took their nice, chaste motorcycle animation, combined it with a standing.
Several of them, actually. They were lying down animations. So I would take that motorcycle sit, have the male lie down, and then have the female crouching over the male for a cowgirl animation.
With just a few hacked animations, Kevin, aka Stroker, had helped unleash a sexual revolution in Second Life. He'd also created endless challenges for Linden Lab's community managers.
Does the name Stroker Serpentine ring a bell?
Yes, it does.
Again, Linden Lab's Peter Allow.
I remember that he was one of the Lotharios of the early, early days, who was there for one purpose. He was there to have virtual sex with as many people as he possibly could in as many ways he possibly could.
What was your relationship with him?
I used him as an example of what the extremes were going to be and what rules we needed to write down. Because no matter what rule we wrote down, he would somehow find some way to get around it. I was grateful in a very strange way because everyone on the team, you would say that, you know, this is going to happen. And somebody invariably would say, oh, come on, no one's going to do that. And Stroker was the guy who absolutely did that thing that you just said that nobody was going to do. So he was my far edge case example whenever I needed it.
So someone would say to you, well, Peter, no one's going to use the tool this way. You know, that's just, it's like, who would do that? And you would say,
give me 5 seconds here. And right there, this guy. Yeah.
Stroker kept employees like Peter busy because those hacked animations were not his only innovation. He also figured out how to embed animations into objects. Like, not surprisingly, a bed. These sex beds would animate avatars into all kinds of sexual positions.
When I released that, it went viral.
So if I had dropped into Second Life back in the day, it was sex beds all over the place.
All over the place, and pornographic images.
Linden Lab had taken a wait-and-see approach to moderation in Second Life. Now the company realized some users were seeing way too much, seeing things that, let us just say, you can't unsee. The question was, what, if anything, should Linden Lab do about it?
The standard that we held each time is this going to turn people away or encourage people in? And the answer to that was annoyingly yes. It would do both. So
so how did you think about that?
We looked at it in terms of, will more people be offended? What's our role in this? What are we going to allow? What's our moral stance? Or a few people who were thoroughly offended by the idea and other ones who were thoroughly encouraging of it. So from a company standpoint, we had a wide spectrum of viewpoints. And the conclusion we came to is plain brown wrapper.
Plain brown wrapper. Peter's talking about how adult magazines used to be sold with their covers wrapped in brown paper. The idea being, if you didn't want to see full frontal nudity every time you stopped by the newsstand, you shouldn't have to. Linden Lab took a similar opt-in approach. If you weren't coming to Second Life for sex, you shouldn't have to see it. In practice, Peter says, this meant segregating sex in Second Life into areas marked as mature, for adults only. In mature areas, consenting adults could largely do what they wanted. And Peter says, this helped. You're the community manager, right? So you're the guy getting the abuse reports?
Yep.
How often were those about sex?
Almost never. It was literally, I can see an image that I'm not supposed to see in my space. Can you please have them hide it? And then I would click on it and say, hey, rules are inside.
Making sex opt-in made Second Life a more welcoming place for more people. But there was another group of users who would not be so easily confined to one area of Second Life. And these users, they didn't want sex. They wanted war. That's after the break. Around the time of its official launch in 2003, another wave of users began entering Second Life. Except this was less of a migration and more of an invasion. These new users came from a multiplayer first-person shooter game called World War II Online. Back in the early 2000s, World War II Online was one of the biggest gaming communities on the internet. It was a place where users could reenact battles across a virtual Western Europe. They could roleplay as American foot soldiers storming Normandy or British paratroopers dropping into Germany. And when Second Life opened its doors, the World War II onliners saw a place where they could do something that they couldn't in their own game. Build.
You could kind of make your own war here.
That's a Second Life user with the avatar named Carl Fredericks. Carl was a big World War II online player back in high school. This was in the early to mid-2000s. And when he saw other players making the jump to Second Life, he followed them.
You play it in World War II Online, you play on the map that other people built. You fight in the towns that other people built. You drive the tanks that other people built. You fly the planes that other people built. You can only really do so much within the confines of how the game is built over there. But over here, if you're a creative person like I am, and my friends were, you can do whatever the heck you want. You can build your own tanks. You can build your own planes. You can build your own little cities to have little fun play battles in.
What side did you play?
Because I was a German in that game, and I even had my German name here. I stayed as a German here.
So you were like in Nazi costume in Second Life.
Yeah, I don't actually have any of those beliefs at all, but somebody's got to be the bad guy.
And you're like, might as well be me?
Yeah. If everybody's a good guy, who's gonna be shot at? Where's the bad guys to get shot at?
When the World War II onliners migrated to Second Life, many settled in a region called Jesse. That's where I met Carl. He flipped through a few different avatar looks before settling on a little green bug-eyed creature. You look like you're out of like a kid's cartoon.
Yeah, this is from Invader Zim.
Jesse was part of an archipelago off of Second Life's mainland. And it was kind of a natural home for the World War II onliners, because Jesse operated differently from other parts of Second Life. Here's Linden Lab's Daniel Huebner again.
A lot of the early adopters of Second Life were people who wanted to play games. So one of the holdovers from a more game-like Second Life was the idea that in certain spaces you could be killed.
Killed, meaning that if your avatar took enough damage, it could die in Jesse. If you quote-unquote died, you'd be teleported back to your Second Life home, where you'd respawn.
We left Jesse as this one place where action, gaming, and violence could continue. So when you went into Jesse, you would suddenly have a health meter, and the residents of Jesse made it clear that you would be participating in an action game. And they'd probably shoot you.
To prevent peaceful Second Life users from getting shot, Jesse was cordoned off from the rest of Second Life by a thick, gray wall. But unsuspecting users still found their way into Jesse anyway. Like Bakara. Bakara Rhodes, the fancy socialite, had moved into Jesse before realizing her new seaside cottage was in a combat zone. And very quickly, Jesse's residents let it be known that she was not welcome. Bakara's cottage became the target of a bombing campaign.
Don't think it could, like, break your house down or something. It couldn't. Just destroy your life if you're in there and, you know, the sounds and everything. And there were other houses, but they seemed to have targeted me, you know. They wanted me out.
Initially, Bakara didn't want to move. And she briefly armed herself with a Tommy gun, the kind you might see in a black and white gangster flick.
You know, sometimes when they would start, I would just go fly over to their place and start shooting. But I didn't want to do it. It wasn't like my thing.
Eventually, Bakara left Jesse. She moved to another part of Second Life. For the World War II gamers, getting shot at and dying multiple times a day was all part of the fun. But when violence was directed at peaceful residents like Bakara, it looked different. It looked more like harassment. But as long as the violence and mayhem stayed confined in Jesse, Linden Lab was largely hands-off. After all, violence was what Jesse had been built for. The problem was that the violence didn't stay in Jesse. The World War II onliners had come to Second Life to build and to fight. But once they were there, many discovered something even more fun. It was called griefing, i.e. making life miserable for their fellow Second Life users. What we might call today trolling. Griefing attacks took the World War II onliners far beyond the Jesse Wall. Like this one time, Carl tells me, when he and a buddy infiltrated a dance club in another region of Second Life. He says that they showed up in suits, posing as normal clubgoers. His friend was carrying a suitcase.
I just put it down there at your feet.
Carl still has this suitcase, and he shows it to me. It's metallic and looks like the kind of thing you'd carry crisply packed $100 bills in. Except he tells me this suitcase didn't carry money. It carried a bomb.
And while we were dancing, the person put a suitcase in the corner. We left. They set off the timer on the suitcase. And as we were leaving, the bomb went off.
Carl sets the timer and demonstrates for me.
Well, we'll just, I guess, wait for that to detonate.
Yes.
So how did...
There it goes. Oh.
Whoa. Jeez.
Suddenly, my entire screen turned orange. I couldn't see Carl. I couldn't see my avatar. All I could see was this bright, burning blast.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Are we in a fireball?
The bomb didn't kill me. Or anyone in the club, back when Carl and his buddy originally set it off. But in Carl's memory, the explosion was so powerful, so technologically taxing, that it crashed that entire region of Second Life. And there were plenty of attacks like this. One time, Jesse's griefers dressed up in ski masks and pretended to be terrorists carrying out suicide missions in Second Life. Another time, they hopped in tanks and raided a nearby neighborhood. But to my mind, the event that really demonstrates that Be Nice was not working, it wasn't a lone suitcase bomb or a suicide attack. It was the time a real war, the Iraq War, to be specific, made its way into Second Life. One of the first people to notice and to write about it was Wagner James Au. James had been hired by Linden Lab to write about events and everyday life inside Second Life. Sometimes he'd do up his avatar like a famous journalist, Tom Wolfe or Hunter S. Thompson, and wander around Second Life looking for stories. And pretty quickly, James noticed that something was up at the wall that divided Jesse from the rest of Second Life.
The Jesse wall, it looks like the Berlin Wall, so it demarcates the peaceful area from the combat area. And people started putting posters up. And so they would be like kind of, I think it was like World War II era posters.
But in the early months of the Iraq War in 2003, the posters began to change. They got political, like posters you'd see in the real world. James says it started slow.
As I recall, the first poster on the wall was kind of a sort of bland support our troops sort of poster, probably from the World War II online folks.
But things picked up quickly.
More and more posters back and forth, and then more and more combat around the wall.
The wall was becoming a front line in a new kind of fight for Second Life. Not a fight over what this world should be, but a fight over real world politics. What started as a battle of dueling posters was quickly escalating into a war about a war.
It was seeing what was playing out in the real world with people kind of yelling at each other or flaming each other in blogs and so on. This is before Twitter. Playing out in 3D in a full immersive, like people actually shooting virtual bullets at each other while putting up posters.
Carl wasn't in Second Life when the war broke out in May 2003, but he heard about it from other World War II onliners.
People would put up posters on their land, you know, like...
Like you would in real life, like a lawn sign?
Like a lawn sign. They would have, you know, so Bush is a fascist, Cheney's a war criminal stuff, and then we'd have stuff like, support the troops, Saddam's a war criminal. And, you know, they would get mad at us and we'd get mad at them. And since, you know, you could pretty much kill people here without consequence, it quickly devolved into violence.
Some of the posters in Jesse crossed the line into hate speech. There were images of Confederate flags and Nazi symbols. And as the violence intensified, Jesse transformed from something recognizable as a combat game to a place that was much more disorienting and surreal.
When it was just fully raging, it was just kind of like this fortress, if you were on acid, like a military fortress on acid, because there would be tanks and helicopters and machine gun emplacements. Someone took a voice clip from Full Metal Jacket, the Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yes, sir! If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You're in the lowest form of life on Earth.
So it was the drill sergeant kind of just shouting, echoing through Jesse when you went in there. So that was strange. And just, yeah, it was very bizarre.
James wasn't the only person noticing that things in Jesse were going off the rails. Peter Allow, Linden Lab's first community manager, was also monitoring the situation around the wall. When the Confederate flag and Nazi posters appeared, he says they moved quickly to remove them. But for Linden Lab, the problems in Jesse went far beyond posters.
Like, what specifically kind of, like, were the complaints that you, as the community manager, were getting from people?
The one that scared me the most was that this isn't fun for me. I don't want to spend my time here because I'm being harassed by people who I don't want to interact with. I think that was actually the biggest one that it overrode all the other ones. Like, I'm being shot. This person is harassing me. This person is saying things I don't like. The usual kind of things that you would expect in an online space where somebody's just being generally rude. But the biggest concern was that people were looking at this as an exit opportunity. That, okay, I came here to play. It was fun for a while. It's not anymore.
As Second Life grew, these problems, griefing, violence, offensive imagery, they only got worse. It all raised the possibility that if conditions didn't improve, users might leave the world altogether. So Linden Lab made changes. A big one was giving people more control over what other users could do to them. Over time, Linden Lab added tools like muting people or blocking them. Say someone was bombing your house, now you could set up an invisible barrier to stop them. But the biggest change that Linden Lab would eventually make would be to revisit its founding principle, be nice. In 2004, Daniel, who was still working on moderation issues, began writing up new rules.
We needed to make rules that were so simple and so concise that they would be internalized by the people who were living in the virtual world, so that they would share these rules to each other. So if we could get them down from being rules into being ideals, they would tell each other, don't do that, that's this violation. Don't do that, we believe in this.
What Daniel wrote became known as the Big Six, a list of six things that could get you kicked out of Second Life. They were intolerance, harassment, assault, disclosure of personal information, indecency, and disturbing the peace. If you violated one or more of the Big Six, you could get suspended from Second Life, or even banned. And some of Carl's fellow griefers were. But not Carl. He's still here. Though not griefing these days, just building. When Carl joined Second Life, he was 15. Today, he's 34. And he says he can see now where Linden Lab was coming from.
Because a lot of the bullshit we pulled before, when it was really Wild West, like the suitcase bombs and stuff, couldn't get away with that anymore today. They'd ban you in a drop of the hat. And that was because of the stuff we did. So I could kind of see from their perspective now, you know, this is their business. This is, you know, a livelihood. This is, we don't want a bunch of troglodytes going around blowing people up just for fun.
Do you miss the old days?
Sometimes. I do miss it sometimes. And I like remembering all the times about, oh, remember that time we jumped into a bunch of tanks and invaded the furry sim? And I can reminisce on stuff like that now, but I don't know if I necessarily want to go start doing that stuff again because we couldn't get away with all the stuff that we did back then.
Of course, for Linden Lab, creating rules was just the beginning. Enforcing them would only get more difficult as the world grew. Daniel told me that when he first joined Linden Lab in 2003, he received just a handful of abuse reports in his first week on the job. When he left, almost 5 years later, they were pouring in. And they were fielded by a team of people, not just Daniel. But once Linden Lab established basic rights and rules, the world became a more welcoming space. Second Life had been niche. But now, it had a shot at being a place for more than just a few thousand people. It could be a place for millions. Maybe for everybody.
if we keep going at this level of success, we can start imagining what to do with income that is 10 times this size or even 100 times this size.
We see these problems. We think we can overcome them. And if we could overcome them, then bang, we're good. We're off to the races. This thing becomes huge.
That's next time on How to Build a Metaverse. How to Build a Metaverse is part of The Journal, which is a co-production of Gimlet and The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Josh Sanborn, with help from me, Annie Minoff, and Alan Rodriguez Espinosa. Our editors are Brendan Klinkenberg and Catherine Brewer. Fact-checking by Nicole Pasulka. Series art by Laura Kammerman. Sound design and mixing by Griffin Tanner. Music in this episode by So Wiley, Audio Network, Blue Dot Sessions, BMG Production Music, and Epidemic Sound. Our theme music is by So Wiley and was remixed by Bobby Lord. Special thanks to Annie Baxter, Rick Brooks, Hannah Chin, Jason Dean, Ryan Knudsen, Kate Linebaugh, Sarah Platt, Pierce Singy, Georgia Wells, and Catherine Whalen. And thanks to the entire Journal team, Melvis Acosta-Crisostomo, Pia Gadkari, Rachel Humphreys, Matt Kwong, Peter Leonard, Laura Morris, Afif Nasuli, Enrique Perez de la Rosa, Aaron Randall, Vladislav Sadiq, Nathan Singapak, and Victoria Whitley Berry, with help from Jonathan Sanders. Thanks for listening. Part 3 will be out next Friday.